para su baño.
Welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And that's Babatunde Lee, and that's from his album, African Tapestry, Prayer for a Continent. I thought it would be great, Prayer for a People. And this is the sixth day of Kwanzaa, Habari Gani, Kuumba Creativity. And we are joined in the studio by Andre, the Wonder Woman. Good morning. How are
you?
Good
morning to you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. And you are going to be a part of this wonderful event at Brava Theater Center tonight, and you're going to help us laugh ourselves into the new year. That's a great, healthy thing to do.
Absolutely essential if we're going to make it through, especially as we approach the so-called fiscal cliff. I think that's what we need is a lot of laughter.
Fiscal cliff. I like that imagery. Yeah, so you're going to be joining Marga Gomez and some other funny lady friends, Pippi Lovestocking, Lydia Popovich, and Eloisa? How do you pronounce her name?
Right. Eloisa, I believe, is how she says it.
Eloisa Bravo. Yeah, so,
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I always love to work with Marga Gomez, and, of course, she's a Bay Area favorite and just a brilliant comic, and so I'm always happy to work with her. And I've also worked with Pippi Longstocking before a number of times, actually. So I think it's going to be a big event and important event for Brava Theater because it's also a fundraiser. But mostly it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so folks can get tickets, $30 for reserved seating, $50 for VIP seating, and complimentary cocktail and more.
Dancing. I think they're going to have a DJ after the show, and I think it's just going to be an all-night party right there in the Brava Theater, and especially for people who live close by, you can come and get your party on and then walk home, so it'll be good, you know what I mean?
Right, right, yeah. And for those that don't live nearby, they can park in the San Francisco General Hospital garage. And, you know, that's not necessarily, we're not doing any foreshadowing here.
Yeah, exactly. And I did hear today that BART's going to be running until 3, so that's really great because people can get out and not have to worry about driving or parking or what have you. And that's a really good thing with the Brava, too, because it's right in the heart of the neighborhood, and coming on BART will probably be a great way to get there.
Yeah. I was speaking to your friend Idris Cooper Anifa Woshe, and
right.
If I'm doing it in the right direction, her name, that is, I keep on getting them mixed up. Is that the right direction? Maid name, then married name?
You know, it's funny, because I knew Idris 20 years ago when I first moved to San Francisco, and she and I haven't been in touch, and it just so happens with this show we're back in touch again, which is great. So I can't help you with the names either. I'm sure you got it close enough, and everybody who knows her and loves her knows who you're talking about.
Right, right. Well, I know I pronounced them correctly. It's just maiden name, then married, or married, then maiden. I'm not certain if I did it in the right direction. But she mentioned that, you know, you all go back to her Sugar Shack days, and I remember Sugar Shack.
Absolutely, and it was kind of my refuge when I first came here because I didn't really know much about the arts community. I wasn't really sure that I was going in that direction or doing anything, and the Sugar Shack was this really cool, welcoming place where you got to meet a lot of different artists working in a lot of different genres and just sort of, you know, all coming together for that creative purpose. So it's really the circle come full for us to get back together.
Yeah, yeah. We were talking a little bit before we went on the air that, you know, you went to school at Wesleyan College. You're real.
At Wellesley College.
Wellesley College, yeah.
Although I have to say I did spend the semester at Wesleyan. Wellesley's in Massachusetts and Wesleyan is in Connecticut.
Okay.
And I did spend the semester there, so you're right on the money.
Right, yeah. And when I was reading your bio, it says that your comedy career began at Steve Harvey's Comedy House in Dallas, Texas. And Steve described you as the new comic with a funny way of saying things. So have you been on his show? Because, you know, he took over the airways for KBLX. So, you know, since your career started there, has he had you on as a guest?
No, he hasn't. And, you know, I know he's still fairly new to the Bay Area with his show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's syndicated or live or how that exactly works.
Mm-hmm.
But, but you know, I take a lot of pride in the fact that I got started at his club. He and I have not been in touch since then.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's mainly because I've been sort of developing my craft and all that, and I figure at some point I will run into him again, and I want to be ready because you can see he has just blown up tremendously. And, you know, I remember him before he became a big star, before the Kings of Comedy and the Steve Harvey Show and all that. And I just remember him as a prince of a guy. He was really supportive to me and gave me a lot of opportunities to perform. And I think once he told me that he thought I had some potential, I was really determined to pursue it, and that's kind of what I've been doing since I started at his club in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and you've won lots and lots of awards as the funniest woman in Oakland and the funniest woman in Half Moon Bay, and you took the first place at the inaugural Russian River Resort Comedy Competition, and then in 2005 you were semi-finalist in the San Francisco International Comedy Competition, and 2008 you were you received the Stand Up for Justice Award from Death Penalty Focus, and then your bio starts moving into like a real interesting political direction. Death Penalty Focus.
Yeah.
And then you're featured in two documentary films about the death penalty. One entitled Outside In, and the other entitled No Tomorrow, that aired on PBS last year in March. So how? Yeah, talk about
how that relates.
Yeah, how that connects. And,
well,
and then when I was looking you up, I found out that you were a death penalty appeals defense lawyer for 17 years. Like, how in the heck does Andre the Wonder Woman meet Andre Heron, the defense attorney?
Right. Well, you know, I tell you, I moved to San Francisco to do death penalty work, and I always felt like, if I'm going to be in California, I might as well do something with show business, right? And I always had this love of the stage and was trying to figure out a way to marry my experiences with my interest in performing. And I just took that plunge in 93. I happened to be going to Dallas to visit my sister, and she took me to Steve Harvey's club. And when I saw these people doing that, I thought, oh, I could do that. And, of course, it's not nearly as easy as it looks. I think the good comics make it look easy, so you think anybody could do it. But getting up there and trying it is a whole different story. But it's very interesting, you know, because I started out my career as a trial lawyer, and it's funny because there are a lot of similarities between trying cases to a jury and doing stand-up, because in a way your stand-up audience is a jury, and they decide, you know, whether you live or die on that stage. So it does have a kind of ironic connection, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Wow. So are you from Texas?
No. Actually, I'm originally from Kansas City.
Oh, seriously? Kansas City, Missouri?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Although I tell people, you know, if you're from there, you're from both places. You're from both sides, basically.
Mm. What do you
Kansas
mean?
City, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, because they're twin cities, you know, and mm-hmm. the state's border, so you're sort of crossing back and forth all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then today, you know, the day before the big day when the Emancipation Proclamation went into law and legally, you know, enslaved Africans were free if they could get away.
Right, if they could get away.
Yeah, your neck of the woods has an interesting history. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, first of all, I often tell people that Missouri is always classified as the Midwest, but it's really the South.
Mm-hmm.
And if you grew up there, you would know that. And it's no accident that it was a Confederate state and that, you know, much of the wrangling around history took place with that state in mind, with the Missouri Compromise and all those different things and Civil War battles fought in that area and so on and so forth. So it definitely has a very, as all the states do, a closely connected involvement with the legacy of slavery and the rest of the legacy in this country, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. And I always like to remind people, because Californians sometimes think we're a little freer than other people, and I always remind them of Malcolm's statement that South is anywhere south of the Canadian border. So it's good to keep in mind, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So what took you into law?
Well, I mean, that was just something that I think at the time I was in college, a lot of people were doing. It was something that I felt would give me some background in understanding how the government works and who rules the corridors of power and that kind of thing. And that's really what got me interested. I had worked for a while before I went to law school in a residential drug program.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to have to go to court to try to convince the court to put these clients in our program as opposed to putting them in jail. And that experience sort of gave me the notion that I wanted to have a little more power in that arena than I had as a worker in a drug program. And I think that's what got me interested in the law. And that's how I found myself studying back in the 80s or whenever it was I was in law school.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I got into it. And, you know, comedy has afforded a great opportunity to take some of the things I've learned over the course of my experience and put it in a comedic context, because I think it gives you this great opportunity to talk about topics that are sometimes uncomfortable or that are not easy to talk about, and you can talk about them and get people to think differently if you put it in a comedic context. So I found comedy extremely useful in that regard, and especially with all the political stuff that's been happening in the last decade or so. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
yeah,
it's been a great medium for that, and I'm sure at tonight's show we're going to be talking a lot about the events of 2012. I mean, I often tell people, you know, when Bush left office, I was a little worried because I thought, oh, wow, now I'm going to have to write my own material. But it seems that the rest of the political characters have kept us comics in clover, so there's a lot to laugh about and talk about as each day goes by, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So do you, like, rehearse your show in advance? How do you prepare for, like, tonight?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think different comics have different ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have more time to prepare because work is not pressing down on me or what have you. But I think as soon as you get a show like this, you start thinking about what you want to talk about, what new material you want to introduce. Of course, I think with a New Year's Eve show, it's almost a different kind of pressure, you know, because you want to do a little retrospective stuff, but you also want to be looking forward, and you want to create a sense of hopefulness and joy and just taking charge of your life and doing it in a fun way, you know. So mm-hmm. I think there's a little added pressure in trying to figure out what is the best material to make people feel that it was really worth their while to come out of the comfort of their homes and be with these other people on New Year's Eve. And so I do a little bit of preparing. I think about the music I want to play. I think about the last joke that I want to leave the stage with, as well as what I want to open with, and how I'm going to bring the energy so that the comics before me and after me benefit from whatever I do on stage. So it's kind of an involved process, I guess, when you think about it, but it can happen mostly in your head. And if you have time, you can rehearse a few things, but, you know, it's kind of hard to do when you don't have a live audience there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
But I think it'll be fun because one thing about these kinds of shows is people really come to have a good time, and so they're already primed, you know, and we're going to have cocktails and that kind of stuff, and that always makes everything funnier. So I think it's going to be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Wow. Have you ever had, you know, to present in front of an audience that wasn't necessarily with you? And how did you sort of, you know, turn it around? I'm sure,
right.
I mean, law.
Well, you know,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's okay, I'm sorry. People always say, oh, my goodness, comedy is the hardest thing. I hate standing up in front of a group, and that would be the most terrifying thing. And, you know, it is terrifying when they don't laugh, let me tell you. But usually when that happens, sometimes you have to break out of whatever your plan was
mm-hmm.
and try to figure out why you aren't connecting. But it's all quite organic, and I think probably the smartest thing you can do as a comic is know when to get off the stage, you know what I mean? Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes it just doesn't work for you, and my view is that has nothing to do with the audience. It's that you as a performer haven't, you know, connected with them for some reason or another. And so I usually just go back to something I know works, or sometimes I just admit, okay, I'm having problems here. Are you guys going to help me out? And that can sometimes be enough to break the ice and get you back on track, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think comedy audiences are really smart, and they really pick up your honesty or lack of honesty. So, and they want you to do well. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm sure you've had the experience of going to a show or hearing a performer and you feel bad for them because you know they aren't doing as well as they would like to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think comedy audiences are always pulling for you, and sometimes just being honest and say, okay, people, what am I doing wrong here, is enough to get them on your side again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's hard to know what to say you would do because every performance is different and every performance is new, and what might have worked for you the night before won't necessarily work. So you have to really be in the moment and try to have an authentic experience with that group of people, even though you might be telling jokes that you've told 1,000 times, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of acting and performance in comedy itself, I guess, which is why some people say it's one of the more difficult mediums. You always hear dramatic actors say they find comedy harder than drama. I see it the other way around, but I think it could be true because it's really about being in the moment. It's really about making that audience feel like this is the first time you had this thought.
Uh-huh.
No, and that's a trick in itself. That is total performance art, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mhm. Right. Yeah.
And mainly,
yeah,
you just want to have a good time. You want it to be. I as a comic, am always chasing this high that happens, like when you're with your friends. Like you probably had some moments like this over the holidays, where you guys are just hanging out, and there's this organic thing that happens because some funny event or something somebody saw or talked about, and it just goes into this whole 10-minute routine that's completely unplanned because people are feeding off each other and riffing and that kind of thing, sort of like jazz, I guess, you know? So you're always chasing that moment and hoping you can make it like when you're in your living room with your best friends and you're totally relaxed and all you're interested in is having fun. And that gets you to a place where you're a lot freer as a performer, you know? And I think everybody enjoys it then.
Right, yeah. Have you ever did comedy on a New Year's Eve, New Year's Day show before?
Yes, yes. Okay. Actually, I did a show a few years ago downtown, like on Nob Hill. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've worked on New Year's quite a bit, and most comics consider it good luck to do so because it means you're going to be working into the new year.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working at 12:01 a.m. on the first of the year, it's,
mm-hmm.
it's usually a good omen that you're going to be working a lot during the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm already happy to get these gigs.
Has it been true?
Yes, yes, pretty much. I mean, I tell you what, you feel a little cheated when you're a comic and you aren't working on December 31st because you just feel like the whole idea is to have fun, and every, you know, it's kind of interesting how most people really love comedy, but many people have never seen a live comedy performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a whole different experience than watching it on television or in a movie or that kind of thing. So I think it's a really fun thing to do, and people usually enjoy it a great deal when they come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're you know, you're a black woman in comedy, and there are, you know, black women comics, you know, historically and presently. And I was just wondering if you want to, like, maybe do a roll call and maybe talk about some of the women, you know, who established, you know, a really strong legacy in this field that it's not necessarily dominated by women, so to have a
right.
the show with all women tonight
mm-hmm.
is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know, it's I mean, I think it's like the rest of society. There certainly is a lot of there are a lot of obstacles and hurdles for you if you're a woman. Sometimes, also, if you're a person of color, I think that's less so now than it was, say, even 20 years ago when I started. You know, when I started was at the height of the Def Jam era, but it was beginning to move into a different motif or whatever. And I think places like Def Jam and Cable and all that gave comics of color a lot more opportunities than they had been afforded in the mainstream. But I do think it's definitely a man's game still, and women have to fight a little harder to sort of get seen and have the kind of success that you see men typically having in this field.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I never thought about comedy as a career choice when I was growing up, but the comic that I knew most as a child was a female comic, African-American comic, was Moms Mabley. She was sort of the standard and the one that you saw a lot of. There were not any female stand-up comics in the realm of people like Joan Rivers or some of those other old-time comics. You see more of that now, like you see the Wanda Sykes and the Whoopi Goldbergs and that sort of thing. But they have typically had to use a little different mechanism for success. You know, they either come through television or through the movies or what have you. I think both Wanda and Whoopi had very successful stand-up careers, like on the nightclub circuit and stuff like that. And I know, for instance, with Whoopi, she really had a lot of success and was catapulted, I think, by her one-woman show where she portrayed Moms Mabley, and I think it was here in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of before I actually got started. This is the lore I've learned about over the years, you know. But you don't see a whole lot of women of color doing comedy in mainstream television other than, say, those two people, and then you see a lot more on cable and that kind of thing. And I think a lot of it has to do with how you decide to work. You know, some people like to work clean. Others prefer to work blue. If you do that kind of work, it may limit how you can get seen and where you can get seen, but it doesn't mean you won't be successful because, you know, I think there's a whole level of comedy where you may not be a household name, but you can still make a fine living doing comedy if you play your cards right and figure out who your audience is and that kind of thing. So I think we're all sort of searching for that breakout moment where whatever it is we are doing out there, somebody sees and it resonates with somebody who can really put you on the map, so to speak, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Are there any, I don't know if you can tell us a joke on the air, because people can't, you can't see the audience and they can't
right.
see you necessarily, but I know, you know, way before television, there was radio. So
yes.
So I know it translates. You want to tell us a joke?
Well, I think my favorite one that I've been doing, because, you know, the election season was a great source of material for a lot of things, and the thing that's really resonated with me of late is how ironic the whole election thing is because, you know, they brought Africans here to pick the cotton and Latinos here to pick the fruit, and now they're picking presidents, you know? You got to love that. And so that's a joke that I have a lot of fun with. And just talking about Obama and the Republicans and how I've decided in 2013 I'm not going to talk about white people in my act anymore. I'm just going to call them Republicans, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And see, I got that kind of cerebral laughter that you just gave me. It'll be a little more animated and fun when I get on stage, but I tend to do sort of political stuff. I do a lot of jokes about the different cultural the cultural differences between various groups in the society. Like I love how white folks love animals. They seem to have a special relationship. And I'm always curious at the things they do. I just saw this story the other day about the guy who took the woman's dog and threw it in the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, my God, what is wrong with people? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But just I don't know. It's hard to – I think some comics are much better at these kinds of radio interviews. That's a genre that I haven't worked in a lot, and I could use a lot of practice.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's hard to make your jokes translate out of context because you have to kind of be there for the whole experience. So I guess I don't have a joke that's making you laugh real hard. You know? But I don't want your audience to be deterred, you know,
mm-hmm.
because
oh,
sometimes
no.
it's hard
yeah.
to come up with that. It's like that's kind of the only profession where people sort of put you on the spot and say, oh, you're a comic, tell me a joke. I have one comedy friend who says when people ask her that, oh, are you funny? She's like, it's not that kind of comedy, you know? So, and I have another friend who does a similar kind of thing who says that people, it's the only profession where people will come up and ask you to do something on the spot. It's like, oh, if you were a boxer, nobody's going to come up and say, oh, you're a boxer, knock me the hell out, you know?
Right.
So it's just one of those things. But yeah, it's a craft, and I guess that's why I've continued to pursue it because I never feel like I've quite mastered it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I just think it's it's a great skill to be able to find humor in a situation that one might not necessarily think is funny. But humor,
right.
You know, and ridicule and funny, you know, these are all words that are sort of in the same bowl, but they don't necessarily, like, particularly, you know, people think ridicule sometimes is funny, but it's not
funny.
The person's being ridiculed. And then you might think about something serious. How can you laugh? How can you, there's some really horrific situations. One can find oneself in a really horrific situation, and yet there can be those light moments within that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I give you made me think of a perfect example of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The topic of death, which nobody wants to talk about. You know, I mean, the whole spectrum of human behavior around death is comical in and of itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been thinking to myself lately that I think that it's rude to die without a plan. And not only should you have a plan, but you ought to pay for that up front. Because think about it. I'm your friend. You die. You don't have a plan. Now I've got to chip in to help bury your dead behind. You know, and it's amazing how that's a topic that's very uncomfortable for people. But when you sort of start thinking about it in a comedic context, you know, it's like, you know, you need a plan. It's not like you don't know it's going to happen. You know what I mean? But it's something that we as humans have a lot of issues around. We have a lot of rituals around. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you just talk about it in a light way, even though it's a serious subject, you know, people can sort of release some of their tension around that. But it's just kind of a whole crazy thing because you are expected to live your life as though you're going to live forever, and you don't even have a clue when you're leaving here. No, you go to work, you get hit by a truck, you know, it's like, hey, I had dinner plans, you know, can I be consulted on this? But it's one of those topics that can make for some good comedic fodder if you can figure out how to tap into that part of it where people are just a little uncomfortable, but they also know it's part of reality, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we've also, you know, heard and there's been a lot of research on the healing nature of laughter, how laughter is real curative, and because people have like so many laughs will cure this and so many laughs will cure that, and just being able to laugh, that physical activity is really good for us.
I think that's right, you know, and when I look at the current situation in Congress, for instance. I've been seeing a lot of Mitch McConnell lately. That's a guy who looks like he never laughs. As a matter of fact, one of my relatives said he looks like he ate something sour.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was so funny when he was on television today talking about he's ready to make this deal and he needs a dance partner. It's like, Mitch, nobody wants to dance with you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right. It definitely has a critical usefulness to our psychological sanity or intactness or what have you. If you don't laugh, it's like living your life without music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. You can't do it. You can't do it and be a healthy person. And not only does it have healing qualities, it's just a better way of moving through life, I think, generally. If you can allow yourself to laugh at yourself, to laugh at others, to laugh at the absurdity of life, and the absolute lack of control that you have over these sort of major things, you know, laughter is about the only way you can get through it.
Right. Yeah. It's a good model, and it's a great way to start the new beginning. January 1st, to leave this particular period and go into the next one, you know, not taking things so heavily, you know, letting things weigh on us. I mean, you know, it is what it is. I mean, you know, we can't change certain things. You know, we don't have as much control as we think we have, so why not laugh about it?
That's right. And believe me, human beings are the best resource of laughter. You don't even have to search very hard for the material. Just look around you. I'm always fascinated by us going in outer space, you know, and it's like we can't take care of the stuff down here. and who do we think we want to be associated with this? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the human condition. I think we create a lot of our own problems, and sometimes all you can do is laugh at our foolishness, like the latest thing with this whole Newtown shooting, you know, which was a horrible tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow some humans think that having more guns is the solution. It's like, how ridiculous is that? Oh, yeah, let's load up the guns with school, you know, the schools with guns. So now the teachers will be accidentally shooting the students, you know? I mean, it's so absurd that it is almost laughable in a way. And somehow you got to try to find a way to take those very difficult experiences and get some insight into our own shortcomings. And I think laughter can help us do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
Yeah. So if people are interested in following you, how do they stay in touch?
Well, they can get to me on Facebook, Andre Heron on Facebook. I'm probably in the next few days going to have a comedy page that's going to be devoted to where I'm going to be in the coming months. And that's one good way to follow me. They can also follow me on Google. I usually always have something popping up there about what I'm doing. Because not only do I do regular stand-up, I do benefits like this. I do a lot of work with the American Civil Liberties Union and Death Penalty Focus, as you mentioned at the top of the show. And I'm still pretty gung-ho on hopefully eventually getting the death penalty abolished in California.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the United States, that's a very serious topic that also can be crazy in terms of how we deal with it and the clients that we deal with and so on and so forth. And, you know, as I was telling you earlier, I usually don't talk about my death penalty work in the comedy context, and that's mainly because it's such a complex issue, and I think people have a lot of misconceptions about it, and it seems for me, a little difficult to make fun of that particular area when I know it involves so many serious issues. But I'm always doing some kind of work around those issues as well as just trying to have fun out there, which is what we'll be doing tonight at the Brava.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a little less serious and a lot more fun, you know, so I hope people will come out and join us.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, the door's open at Brava Theater at 8 o'clock, and the comedy festival starts at 9, and then afterwards there's going to be a countdown party, a DJ, and dancing until into 2013, and again, tickets are $30 for reserve seating and $50 for VIP seating, which includes complimentary cocktails and more, and as Andre, the Wonder Woman, said, the proceeds benefit Brava for Women in the Arts. And Brava Theater is located at 2781 24th Street at York, Y-O-R-K. It used to be a theater. It's actually, now it's still a theater, so it looks like a theater. It's a big, big, you know, marquee in the front, and, yeah, it's not hard
really
to find.
I think it has a really beautiful mural and all that stuff, too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's right in the Mission, and it is a really beautiful mural on it, and it says Brava, and the phone number there is 415-647-2822, and there's a website as well. You might be able to buy tickets on the web to make sure you get in there.
Yes,
but,
I think you can, and come early, because come on BART if you can, because I know parking is difficult around there, but I know it's going to be crowded. The Mission's always bustling with activity, and that place, the Brava's going to be popping tonight because it's a very popular spot, and as I said, Marga is a great draw. People love to come see her, and she's going to be the star of the show, and it's going to be a lot of fun. You need to be on the scene in 2013.
Well, cool. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Andre, for joining us to talk about laughter and 2012 into 2013 and your work in the abolition of the death penalty here in California and throughout the United States. And we definitely, you know, had a wonderful resolve with regards to the three strikes, you know, making the third
yes.
strike, you know, a violent felony as opposed to just anything. So that
right.
was wonderful.
One step at a time, you know, we'll just keep at it till we get it right.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and then earlier this year, it was really great that women who are pregnant are in California are no longer shackled during
yes.
childbirth, which is and also transport. So that's great too.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we can do to make the world a better place, a more humane place, and dignity for all people, that's what it's really all about.
Mm-hmm.
And laughter is where you start.
That's right. All right. Well, you take good care, and
well,
Happy New Year.
Thank you so much, Wanda, and Happy New Year to you.
All right. Thank you.
To all your listeners.
Okay. Peace and blessings.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. So we are going to play Adimu Mayun's Wolf, Hawk, Jaguar, and his piece is called Nothing Else Seems to Matter.
Celebrating life, feeling divine. I'm alive.
That was Ademu Mayun, Wolf, Hawk, Jaguar. And you notice that I mispronounced the title. It's actually Nothing Else Seems to Mind. Uh-oh, gosh. We are joined in the studio by Teresa Schultz, who's going to be telling us about her father, Russell Maroon Schultz, who has a book coming out in a couple of months, which is really exciting. Good morning, Teresa. Thank you, or good afternoon where you are, good morning where we are. And thanks so much for fitting us into your schedule. You know, I know you're visiting a sick friend right now. Uh-oh, did we lose her? Oh, no. Oh, darn, she's gone. Okay, so I will have to get her back into the studio. And in the meantime, let me tell you a little bit about Russell Maroon Schultz. He is a dedicated community activist and founding member of the Black Unity Council, former member of the Black Panther Party, and a soldier in the Black Liberation Army. He is serving multiple life sentences presently as a U.S. held prisoner of war. And the book that's coming out is called Maroon, the Implacable, the collected writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. And it's edited by Fred Ho and Quincy Saul, with a foreword by Chuck D and an afterword by Matt Meyer and Nozizwe Madlala Rutledge. And so this is going to be out on PM Press, I believe. Let me see. I think it's going to be out around March of this year coming, so that's really exciting. So we should look forward to that. And so now let me play something else while we get our sister back in the studio. And let's see, what are we interested in playing? Let's play a little bit of Alan Kimara Dixon's Appreciation. Thank you. Appreciation. That was Alan Kimara Dixon. And now we're going to play, I was looking at Abraham Burton's Amina Nebulae. That's a long one. It's a nice one, but it's a long one. So I might not be able to play all of that if we get our sister back in the studio. We shall see.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi, Teresa. We're trying it again.
Okay, good enough.
Yeah, I already told our audience a little bit about your father.
Okay.
From the bio that's on the press release. And
okay.
Want to share a little bit about you. Teresa Schultz is the daughter of Russell Maroon Schultz and has been a community organizer for over 20 years. Donating most of her time to the Human Rights Coalition of Philadelphia, HRC Fed Up, Decarceration Pennsylvania, and Scientific Soul Sessions. That sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
She
right.
has fought tirelessly for her father's freedom during his 2 decades in solitary confinement. She worked for 8 years in the Philadelphia public school system and founded an after-school program to counsel youth battling homelessness, parental drug use, gang-related violence, gender issues, and sexual abuse. She has been a pillar of support to the families of incarcerated men and women in her community, organizing and executing trips to prisons for relatives to meet their loved ones and exercising an open-door policy in order to counsel community members on the traumas brought about by mass incarceration. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, Greater Ford Prison Chapter, recently honored her dedication to families and communities throughout Philadelphia. So welcome to the show, and yeah, really happy to have you on to talk about your father's long sentence, my goodness, and, you know, he's been incarcerated for over 30 years and with 20 years of solitary confinement. And so I wonder if you could talk about your father and his work and leader in the Black Liberation Movement in Philadelphia, both above and underground, and how he came to be called Maroon, and this upcoming book, Maroon the Implacable, The Collected Writings of Russell Maroon Schultz.
Yes, and thank you for having me, because with the rate of communication for our Black communities being just dissolved and diminished, and so much candy-coated information out there, our not only our youth, but our community in the whole is lost for real information. And just by you having this platform and standing up against the norm of the type of media that we're getting, I really appreciate that. My father actually is approaching 70 years of age. He'll be 70 August 2013. And he's actually been in 40 years inside of prison and some 30 years in solitary confinement. And we have begun a mass campaign to have him released from solitary confinement. Now, throughout the years, within the last past 10 years, we've been often told by prison officials that he's a leader. You know, he has a number of young Black male and brown male prisoners who really follow his lead and who admire his ability to withstand this long-term solitary confinement. My father now is locked up at a prison in Waynesburg, PA, called SCI Green. And before Mamiya was released from death row just this year, he served a sentence. He was sentenced to death row at the same prison, SCI Green. Now that the people's fight for Mamiya's release from death row has freed him from death row, we're still fighting to have him released because he's innocent. And if you're going to release him from death row, that's not only a stand that the people took to make sure that he's released, but we also want the sentence gone. But now Mamiya is presently in population at SCI Mount Hanoi in Pennsylvania. So he's no longer SCI Green where my dad was. So my dad, what he did was, before he was in prison, he really fought against injustice in his community in West Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And he began the United Council. And they eventually merged with the Black Panther Party. And from there, Daddy took a stand, not only to, well, actually a stand on the front lines, because he joined the Black Panthers, and then he became a BLA member. And he was staunch about the freedom of his black people and also the youth. And somehow, I guess with the same blood running through my veins, I've taken a stand also in my community to protect our youth from this war that's being waged against black youth and black and just anyone that's poor. And with that, Daddy and I came up with an organization called Family and Communities United. And I went to 3 schools in my neighborhood in West Philadelphia, and I just went to the schoolyards where the parents were picking up kids and just notified them that I would be doing a free after-school program for youth who have a loved one in prison, whether it be mothers or fathers, aunts, uncles, whoever. You know, this program would be offered where I would pick kids up from school and to help them with homework and drumming and all kind of other cultural activities. And no one took me up on that offer, and I was kind of stunned. And I spoke with my dad on his normal weekly call from the prison. He said, "What did the flyer say?" And actually, I wasn't aware at that time that you can't throw free at folks, especially involving their children, because why are you going to do something for my kid that's so free? Because as we celebrate Kwanzaa now, we have forgotten how to come together and how to help our people in our community, how to help others who may be less fortunate or maybe just need some type of help. So I took out free. I took that off the flyer. I took out anything that said prison. And I went out with a new flyer with just after-school program, pick up kids from school, drop them off at home, and I was swamped with more than 70 families. Although my truck only held 8 to 10 kids, I had to really do an interview of these families, 70-something families, and try to bottom line who definitely or who really needed this service that I was offering. And what I found out was that not only were all of these families affected by the prison system, most of the kids were in foster care systems. The families that housed these youth that turned up for my service had mothers and fathers in prison, therefore they were placed into foster care homes. So with that, it was a really heavy load, and I was overwhelmed and very upset at the same time. Although I knew I could offer services in my community, I was upset that I didn't have others or a church that would open the door to more families that I could help. As a matter of fact, a church did open the door, but when I went in charge of fee for the after-school program, after 3 months of after-school program in their church, they gave me the boot. They kicked me out because they wanted monies. And I, how could I charge a family money or a kid that's in foster care who families are in prison? I just couldn't do it. And with my dad being in prison for some 40 years, as a child, I wished. Now, when I was a kid, there weren't, the word prison wasn't as big as it is now with 2 million plus folks behind bars. I was like the only kid in my elementary school who had a father in prison. So when I needed to get something off my chest or talk about this prison thing, there wasn't anyone outside of my family I could do that with. And to bottom line, the help I've been doing in my community, when I so what I did with the after getting booted out the church because I wouldn't gain them any money, I just took the kids that day to the public library. So there was no overhead of paying any utility bills. There were computers. And what I found out that none of my kids had a library card. So that in general just really pushed me forward to do more. And now what I'm seeing with my community running amok, youth are just on the corners, is almost looking third world to me today, where there looks as no positive outcome from them, nor do the youth in my community feel like there's anything to live for. So what I'm doing now, within the last year, it'll be a year in February, I've been taking in foster children. And my goal was to really just work with some little ones. I wanted to give them a good ground base, give them some consciousness and educate them. And all I was getting thrown was, not thrown, but what was being offered were teenagers. And I said, I really don't want to do these teenagers. They're like out of order. And my dad had a talk with me. He said, how can you say that? How can you say the youth are out of order, the teenagers in your community, if you don't do something about it? And it hit me like a ton of bricks. So I started taking in teenagers. I've had two 17-year-olds, one 13, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old. I've had 5 kids in my home, and it hasn't even been a year.
Wow. Huh. Wow, so when you, if your father's been incarcerated for 40 years, you said?
Yes.
So you didn't have much time with him before he went inside, right?
No, not at all, because I'm approaching 49, and I think my dad was arrested around when I was about 7 years of age, maybe a little early, back in 71. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have much time with him, and now our visits 20-plus years have been behind glass, so nor have I touched or hugged him in 20-plus years.
Oh, behind glass? How come?
Because we'll get into that. My dad has liberated himself. He escaped, and I am so proud of him. I admire him. He's like my hero, that he was able to liberate himself from 2 prisons. Although he was recaptured and he didn't harm anyone on these escapes, he just said, I'm not going to stay in jail for a crime I didn't commit, nor am I going to be, I'm a political prisoner, and I'm also in here for fighting for my beliefs and fighting for the love of my people. So he's been placed at one of the super, super most maximum security prisons in Pennsylvania, and that's SCI Green. When it was built, and when it was finished, my daddy was transferred there, and it's been more than 16 years. But they continue to keep his visits isolated like this and behind glass because of his history of liberating himself. But when he was transferred to this prison, it's 7 hours away from Philadelphia. We protested against that, but it was said that we would get really good visits with him because he had to be transferred there because he wouldn't be able to escape. But ever since he's been there, he's been behind glass, and we haven't had any quality visits with him. He's only allowed 1 hour a week, 1 call a week. There's 23 hours in a cell where he's allotted 1 hour into like a big fence dog cage. And that is outdoors, so he leads from one cage to another. and he's alone in that cage, the 1 hour. Now, I can tell you this. The week that it was discovered that Mamiya would be released from death row, the guards came to my dad and asked, no, I'm sorry, they went to Mamiya and asked, do you want to get with the old man before you leave this prison? And he said, of course. And they did. They had Mamiya and Russell Schultz in two fence cages next to each other. 3 days, they would come out 1 hour into the dog fence cage, and they could talk. And it, Mamiya said it was the coldest days when he was released, but it was well worth the time to get to spend an hour a day with Russell Maroon Schultz, that he had learned so much that it was well worth all the time that he had spent there to be with Maroon and to learn so much from Maroon. The other thing that he stated was that he didn't realize how bad solitary confinement was at SCI Green. Because now, let me tell you, Mamiya was on death row. Mm-hmm. Now, whether people believe this or not, solitary confinement is worse than death row at SCI Green. See, when you talk about prisoners being on death row, mm-hmm. some people say that if this person knows they're guilty, or whatever, however you define guilty, they have nothing to lose. So Mamiya was allowed talk show interviews. He was interviewed with someone with a camera inside of SCI Green. He had a typewriter. All of this stuff my dad never had just in solitary confinement, nor would they give it to him. So folks were thinking, death row is also, don't get me wrong, I'm not making one better than the other. Mm-hmm. But in the case of these two guys, and I think that's why they came to Mamiya and said, do you want to talk to the old man? Because although they were in the same prison more than 16 years, they never were able to come in contact with each other. Mm-hmm. Because can you imagine what that conversation was like between them? We know when they offered this that those outdoor cages were probably rigged with tapes where they could listen mm-hmm. in on their conversation. But, I, you know, that would have been some education to be able to sit in with Mamiya and Russell Schultz. I mean, even just for an hour. They had 3 days, an hour each visit mm-hmm. in the cage. Separate cages, but yet they could yell at each other.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I'm going to tell you, I've been watching closely what's going on in California prisons. And when you see prisoners come together and say, we're taking a stand, not only do we want to fight against each other, we want to shut down the injustice, the solitary confinement unit, these gang-related traps that they are using against folks, black and brown folks in the prison. When you see gang members or any prisoners that usually normally may not come together, that they are coming together, if that's not enough to have folks come together on the outside and say, hey, we got to change this prison system. Hey, we got to free our political prisoners. We got to save our youth, because this is not a game. See, it's a game to these folks who are invested in this prison system. We've all been bamboozled. I mean, especially working American folks who are paying taxes, we've been bamboozled to foot the prison bill. Our taxes pay for the prison. So I feel mighty guilty right now to know that I'm helping to carry on and create and build new prisons right here in Pennsylvania. Yet, this year, Philadelphia School District is going to close 37 to 40 schools in 1 year. And you're talking about your area and in the hood and in the black communities looking like they're going to be third world. They will be, because education is what keep us abreast? What keeps you and I on top of this present thing? You and I on other issues that we know are affecting poor people. Now, when you talk about people that are uneducated, people who already think, young guys, that they don't have anything to live for, and then you take away the education. And not only do you take that away and you build SCI New Phoenix Prison, that's going to cost well over $100 million, and you talk about schools that are closing, that don't even have textbooks, but yet you can build two more new prisons. So therefore, although my daddy started the Human Rights Coalition Group, HRC, there's an HRC Philadelphia chapter and an HRC Fed Up chapter in Pittsburgh. Daddy started that group with nine other prisoners, and they are our board members. Because if we have 2 million prisoners in prison, if just one family member started a HRC chapter throughout the in whatever state they're in, and we had that family member throughout the country, we would be a force that no one could touch, and that the politicians would have to bow down to. I've been told time and time again, when it came to saving my dad's life, now my dad is 70. Of course, he's experiencing medical issues that affect elderly, and not only that, elderly black men, such as prostate issues, cataract. I had to fight 4 months, visiting my governor twice, a 3-hour trip, the Secretary of Prisons in Pennsylvania, and the Chief of Staff of the Medical Department that places doctors in the prison system just to get him cataract surgery. He was actually told, oh, hey, wait a minute. If we do one eye, we're not doing the other. You just have to go blind in that eye. And when Daddy told me that on the phone, I was on Amtrak the next morning to the agency that runs this, that has the prison system medical team under their belt. Now, when you get to these offices, they don't expect you to come. And I was asked as I walked through the door, what do you want? Why are you here? Well, my dad's life is on the line. That's why I'm here. And although you're the agency that was accepted to provide medical for the entire Pennsylvania state prison system, you had the cheapest bid. So therefore, I know there's a certain amount of money allotted to each prisoner for medical, but you're going to try not to use it all. But you will with my father. I stress that folks get involved, that if you have a loved one in prison, you can fight against any injustice that is happening to them. The doctor that my dad has is a doctor who has so many medical malpractice suits under his belt that he's not even allowed to practice anymore, but in the prison system. So right now I'm getting ready to fight for his left eye to have the cataract surgery. I just visited with my dad about 4 days ago, and he couldn't even read the numbers inside of the booth we were in, because each booth is numbered. And he said, hey, listen, you got to help me. I can't see. You got one eye fixed for me, but we need the other eye. Now, what I do also is lend my phone number out, my private line, my home number to family members, because when there is an issue like this, your loved one can die behind bars. Now, what I do is I stay on the phone with that loved one who is questioning the prison system about the health care of their loved one behind bars. And most of the time you get, why do you want to know? We're doing what we need to do. You know, you just wait and we'll call you. And they never call. So with my expertise in handling the Pennsylvania prison system, normally I get the family through and we get the medical attention that's needed. Now, about 7 years ago, Daddy was fighting for just a PSA blood test to see where his prostate levels were. That took me about 5 months, but Daddy got out and was taken to a hospital, and there was another prisoner who had been, was put on that transfer trip also to the prison, and he broke down, thanking my dad and thank your daughter, because I've been trying to get this test for 7 years. Now, come and Daddy come back from the hospital there in the sheriff's van. They, of course, they're chained and shackled, and this guy tells my dad, this fellow prisoner, that he already has cancer, it's far gone, and that he ends up dying. So that's where we are, and that's why we started the Human Rights Coalition group, where you can call on us. We will help you fight against the prison system. What we have also done, if you go to HRC.org, we have documented every accusation of abuse that comes into our office from prisoners throughout Pennsylvania and even outside of Pennsylvania. And the guard's name, the date of the abuse, whether it was sexual, whether it was physical abuse, whether it was lack of medical attention after being beat up maybe by the guards, we have it all documented. So you can go in right to our site and see we have documented over hundreds and hundreds of allegations of abuse. It got so good that the Federal Justice Department just last year acknowledged that prisoners at SCI Pittsburgh were being sexually abused by guards. 7 guards were taken and suspended from SCI prison and SCI Pittsburgh, I'm sorry, and there's a lawsuit being brought against those guards. Not only did they rape a lot of the homosexual male prisoners, they also had a fight ring where prisoners were forced to fight each other. So the Federal Justice Department actually acknowledged us, HRC Pennsylvania and HRC Fed Up Pittsburgh, for helping them to log into our, not helping them to log in, but they looked at what we had documented on our website.
Wow.
So our goal is from state to state to push this injustice out there, put it in the forefront. And I always stress to family members, don't be ashamed that you have a loved one in prison. Hey, you know, HRC has been trying to do a church tour, right? We have these big mega churches in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia, some newly built big churches, and you have, I would say more than 25%, maybe 50% of those members who have been in prison and turned their lives around through ministry, Christian ministry, or they have a loved one in prison. And you have women in the church, grandmothers, mothers, aunts, sisters, who, like, I call it hiding behind big church hats and don't want to acknowledge that they have a loved one in prison. Now, don't get me wrong. These churches do have their little prison ministry. And they go inside the churches and they teach prisoners gospel hymns and scripture and stuff like that. But what are we doing once that prisoner is released? Okay, what are we doing for that prisoner while he's inside? How can the church become involved? And what we're getting now is nothing, from no feedback from the big churches. We introduced a tour that we could do with a film documenting present-day prison issues. None of them will take the bait. None of the churches here. I mean, let me go back to say the black churches. We have addressed every last one of them here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. You know, as a youngster, when your father you know, was incarcerated and
mm-hmm.
you know, and since then, you know, you had to visit him and
mm-hmm.
there were no contact visits. Talk about, you know, the support system. You said that at that time you were the only child in your school or within your class that had the situation that you had. Now it's a lot more prevalent. You know, a lot of children,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, are experiencing
mm-hmm.
this. So talk about, you know, sort of your support system, you know, so that you could.
Well, I had none. I had none.
Some of
my
your
dad
family?
Would escape.
Oh, really? Oh.
Well, my dad would escape, right? And I lived right across the street from the public school, and they would evacuate the school. The cops would be at our door. All the kids would be up against the gate, peering through the gate at our home while the SWAT team, the state police, and every other enforcement agency would kick in our door, and I had to watch that. Dogs would be involved. They had their dogs, these security teams, and my mom would be there, and my mom was totally terrified. And this is why, part of the reason, and I'm not blaming my mother. I love my mother because she struggled financially while my dad was incarcerated. And why my mom, being from the South and moving to the North and meeting my father before I was born, she asked him often, why are you doing this stuff? Daddy was young, and he had heard Malcolm X speak in New York City. And from there on, he said he had to make change in his community. And once he was back in Philadelphia, that's when he started organizing. My mother kept saying, why? You shouldn't do this. My mom was nervous about what he was doing. And it was just educating folks in his community. And, you know, standing up for change. And my mom was terribly terrified. So, therefore, my mom separated from my dad, and we were living with my mom. So then when Daddy is incarcerated, he escaped.
So you have siblings?
I have siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's seven of us.
But oh, wow.
My mother's children, my dad has children by another woman, and that was after him and my mother separated. But the two of my siblings,
mm-hmm.
we're
okay.
the ones really fighting for my dad's freedom. So, yeah, there was no support for, I mean, we have family. Oh, and my father's siblings, my aunt, his sisters and brothers were very supportive of us because they felt the same way he felt about the injustice that was going on in the 60s and the 70s and up to the present day. But, yes, we had that, but no kids or their parents were talking about prison issues. The only talk I got from kids, and I thought at that time it was a bad thing, but it wasn't. I was just young. Kids were bringing newspaper articles about my dad.
Oh.
And his escape, and, you know, and their families would be saying, you know, that's that kid, his father, you know, is locked up. And the kids looked at me strange and like as if I was different because a lot of them did have two parents in the home. Or if they didn't, they didn't have a loved one in prison. Mm-hmm. And then when they would see our house, our door being kicked in and the dog, one kid said to my brother, hey, Russell, I love when your father escapes because my brother is Russell, named Russell also. And then he was a year because we get a day out when your dad escapes. So, you know, no. And this is why when I did my after school program, every Thursday I had get it off your chest, these kids. Because although they had a loved one in prison, and although it's prevalent, it's almost seemed like the norm, these kids are still kind of ashamed because a lot of folks aren't talking about prison. But although they can tell you, oh, my cousin in prison, my brother, they can list off a number of people in prison. So I would have get it off your chest day after homework. Some kids would just break down. Couldn't even talk about the prison system, but they would draw it. I would give them pencil, color paper, color pencil, crayons, and they would draw the cell with their brother. I can remember one kid, his brother was 19 and had recently been, and he couldn't talk about it. And this kid not only had a brother in prison, his mother was in prison. He was suffering with sickle cell, so he was often in a hospital. He really couldn't talk, and his emotions were only show through him coloring. So then an assistant that I had working with me at the after school program came up with a wonderful idea. And one day I'll mail you a copy. He came up with a coloring book And when you open the coloring book, well, on the cover was all a picture of all my kids in the after-school program. But when you open it, it had all our heroes, all our leaders, Lamia, Sudie Otis, Russell Maroon Shields, Robert King, the Angola 3, and it just went on and on and on. And then these kids not only, you know, after get it off of their chest and doing the activities, could color in our heroes, our political prisoners and loved ones. They could create their own picture. Also in the back, there were blank papers for them to draw their loved one, a picture of their loved one that's in prison.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So talk about the book that's coming out in a couple of months, maybe three months.
And listen, I give all props to Scientific Soul Session because although we look at my dad as this strong figure who has been incarcerated so long and approaching 70 years of age, he was becoming, he was mentally drained. And my visits last year, I could see it. There's not much laughter from him anyway, but I didn't even see much of a smile. So I see a big change in him. This solitary was really becoming stressful because when you think about a visit, now let's look at, I'm going to visit my dad. He's going to be behind glass. We have to ask for an extended visit beyond the 1 hour because we have to drive 7 hours to my dad and then turn right back around in an hour and drive back 7 more hours home. So we would ask for an extended visit to give us extra hours. But before that visit, Daddy is aware of when we're coming because we also have to get him a 3-week notice that advance that we're coming, right, or we can't visit. Daddy has to go through this search. Now, listen, we're behind glass. He's chained at his hands. He's chained at the wrist. He's chained at the ankle.
He's chained
he's
in the visit?
Glass. Yes, behind
really?
Glass.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if Desmond Tutu visited Mamia and asked the prison officials. He demanded that Mamia be unchained during his visit, and he was. And therefore, after Desmond Tutu's visit with Mamia, from there on, Mamia was never chained at the ankle or that wrist during his visit. But now remember, Mamia was on death row. Desmond Tutu made the prison officials look really bad and announced that he didn't want to ever see him like that again. Now, that was changed for Mamia. Mm-hmm. Daddy, no. He's still behind this thick glass, and the door is locked behind him. There are two guards standing outside of that, yet he's chained. But bigger than that is that the search that he has to go through. There's a cavity search, his anal is searched, his mouth, he's stripped butt naked, and then he comes into the visit. Now, that's traumatic in itself. So I can see the stress on my dad last year. But then you have to leave that visit and get the same check. And it's just, it's dehumanizing. And so although you're upbeat about this visit, but then all these men are surrounding you and checking every cavity, everything, anything that has to open it, you know. So my visits for me are very uplifting. I leave there with, like, I'm energized with a battery because he's so on point about everything. So this book is a detailed writing of 7 essays Daddy has been writing, and what they at Scientific Soul and PM Press managed to do was to merge all of those writings into one book, and it is awesome. You know, we're going to do a tour beginning late March, all of April, and we'll be in Vermont. We'll be crossing across the country, and hopefully I can I know we're going to do California. I don't know if I'm going to be on that tour, but would love to see you doing that tour. But this book is something that hasn't been done in reference to Maroon's writings. Now, you can purchase Maroon's writings in little pamphlets, like each of the 7 surveys. You can always purchase those, but now we have them in one book. So, you know, you're not looking for the writings, and he has one that is a fighting formation. So that's one of the essays. Then he has one, Death by Regulation in Solitary Confinement, because at SEI Green with Eddie's house, there have been more suicides by boys in their 20s who were placed, not boys, young black men, who were placed in solitary confinement at SEI Green. They end up hanging themselves. Now, you look at a man like Maroon. He's been in solitary confinement 20-plus years. Now, you look at a young black male that comes in prison, and he's in his 20s, and he's placed in solitary confinement for whatever reason. And most of them don't even make it a month being in the cell 23 hours a day. So Daddy has one of the essays is Death by Regulation, and that regulation is solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. So I ask folks to look up the history of SEI Green and our young black males who have killed themselves while in solitary confinement.
Wow.
Now, yet our government is holding on to this out. They're fighting tooth and nail to keep it. And, you know, we have fighting us too. We're stronger than that this government is. You know, we're talking about a government, though. It's going to be a strong fight that the people are going to have to do, because we're talking about a government, our government, who don't give a damn about women, nor do they care about children. Nor do they care about education of our children or medical, any medical assistance. So we're all being just, you know, hammered down, and they're at war against us. So we're going to have to stand up and come together.
Yeah,
and,
let me read a little bit from the press release about the book. It's, you know, as you mentioned,
sure.
The tour is between March 27th, 2013 and May 6th. 2013, and Quincy Saul, co-editor, and Teresa, yourself, are going to be traveling, hopefully, in this tour. Hopefully, you'll be coming this way. And it says that your father, you know, as you mentioned, his successful escapes from maximum security prisons earned him the title Maroon. And Maroons were those Africans in Jamaica, really well known, particularly Nanny Maroons, who went into the Blue Mountains. But they established, you know, African centered communities during enslavement. And this particular collection of his essays is the first published collection of his accumulated written work, but it also includes some new essays written expressly for this volume. So I know a lot of his work is online and available at your website, but then there's some special essays written for this particular volume. And I'm going to read some of the bullets from here so people can get sort of a sense of the type of topics that are covered in his work. Despite the torture and deprivation that has been everyday life for Maroon over the last several decades, he has remained at the cutting edge of history through his writings. His work is innovative and revolutionary on multiple levels. His self-critical and fresh retelling of the black liberation struggle in the U.S. includes many practical and theoretical insights. His analysis of the prison system, particularly in relationship to capitalism, imperialism, and the drug war, takes us far beyond the recently popular analysis of the prison industrial complex contained in Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and others such as that. His historical research and writings on Maroon communities throughout the Americas draw many insights from these societies in the fields of political and military revolutionary strategy are unprecedented. And finally, his sharp and profound understanding of the current historical moment, with clear proposals for how to move forward embracing new political concepts and practices, including but not limited to eco-socialism, matriarchy, and eco-feminism, food security, prefiguration of the Occupy Wall Street movements, providing cutting-edge challenges for today's movements for social change. So I was wondering, I was noticing this whole thing around matriarchy, and I don't know the essay, and I don't know the writing around that, but I was wondering if you could talk about sort of your father's analysis and around matriarchy, because it sounds really interesting.
And it is. And I can't really bottom line everything for you on that subject because he asked me to wait until the book is published.
Oh.
But what I can do is tell you that my dad, that Russell has seen, is seeing family. He's seeing women in a different light because he had this, like, male macho way about himself, especially as a pastor,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you and I and others and women around the country and people, members of the Black Panther Party, know that the women were the backbone of that organization, that they were very powerful and helped keep the world running, as well as the male Panther. So now Daddy, not acknowledging that early on, and as he was when he was a Panther, he now really sees what role they played in with the Panther organization. Now he's also very keen on family and looking towards our ancestors and for spiritual guidance. And he's also told me on the last visit 4 days ago that the Native Americans mm-hmm. and the way that they live and the way that they currently live is the way that he will hope to see our nation go, come to grips with, you know, like more family-oriented. He even suggested that my siblings and I and my mother all move into one house, and my mom being a matriarch, you know, we would adhere more to some of her suggestions and her background of how she was raised in the South. And so that's the, as much as I can tell you, I really want folks to pick up the book and or visit the website and see when we're in your area, and we'll really detail everything.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Where in the South is your mother from?
Oh, she's actually out of Virginia, Portsmouth, Virginia. So when her and Daddy met, my mom had wanted to leave the South, as a lot of blacks migrated during the 60s to the North. And she did. She came to Philadelphia, and they didn't have family here. But her and her siblings, three of her siblings, managed to find a place. And then she met my father within the first year of coming to Philadelphia from Portsmouth, Virginia. And as I said, Maroon was already caught up in activism. But my mom is this 19-year-old girl from the South who's very scary and don't think that you should rebel against, you know, present-day government and stuff like that. So although they had three children together, it didn't last because my mom and her were just on different planes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so
I
hope I've been okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was noticing. I wanted to mention, you know, that Chuck D, you know, one of the leaders of the group Public Enemy, who is, you know, extremely political and socially conscious, and it comes out in his music, hip hop culture. You know, he does the forward, and then Fred Ho, he is phenomenal. I've interviewed Fred Ho on a number of occasions. And he is a jazz baritone saxophonist, composer, band leader, playwright, writer, and social activist. And he's one of the founders of Scientific Soul Sessions.
That's right.
And I was wondering if you could, and you're a part of Scientific Soul Sessions.
Well, I'm a new member. New member, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you've got Nosizwe Matlala Rutledge, and she's from South Africa. She's a South African activist and politician. And the former chairperson of the ANC Parliamentary Caucus, Deputy
mm-hmm.
Speaker of the National Assembly, and a whole lot of other stuff. And she's currently the Executive Director of Embrace Dignity, an organization that embraces the dignity of all people and steadfastly opposes the sexual and commercial exploitation of those rendered powerless and vulnerable by absence of choice. And then Matt Meyer, author of and editor of 6 books, including 4 titles on contemporary Africa, and PM Press's Let Freedom Ring, a collection of documents from the movements to free U.S. political prisoners. That's
mm-hmm.
such a well-researched volume. Oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you.
It doesn't get any better than that, does it?
No.
It's incredible.
It's definitely incredible. So I wanted to ask you, because I know you need to get back to the reason for being at the hospital. But I was wondering, in closing, since today is, you know, the last day of the calendar year, December 31st, you know, Kuumba, or creativity in the Nguza Saba, and then also, you know, January 1st, 1863, when
That's
the Emancipation
right.
Proclamation went into law, is having its 150th anniversary this year, tomorrow, January 1st,
mm-hmm.
Imani, or Faith in the Nguza Saba. And then your father, his birthday is in August, and
mm-hmm.
August is also the month where
mm-hmm.
Martin King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington has its I Have a Dream speech has its 50th anniversary. It's like
mm-hmm.
50 years, man. It's like, seems like that's so close, right? I mean, it's like
mm-hmm.
that's not that long ago. And so I just wanted to get like some closing comments on that.
Well,
and also, you know, we think about
uh-huh.
you know, prison, and we think about slavery, and we think, oh, slavery's over. No, it's not.
It's not. No. And you know, this is I can tell you, when Occupy kicked off,
mm-hmm.
my dad was really, like I was, in an uproar with excitement because this was young folks, whether it be if they were white or black, who was rising up against the present-day system. So this entire year for me and going into 13 is a powerful time to be acknowledged and to make a change. Actually, tonight, I'll bring in a New Year's at the UNIA Marcus Garvey building in North Philadelphia. All right. And we're going to, in 1862, I think our ancestors, well, not think, 1862, the ancestors were, you know, just focused on their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight we're going to drum and bring in our ancestors and acknowledge that time. So this new year for me is always about freedom. I'm looking at a new year of freedom for our people and change. And also to celebrate this evening with my peers who feel the same way that I do. As we go into this new year, I think with all the prominent dates and important dates that we really, really, as I've stressed throughout this call, have to be in contact with our young folks and educate them about political prison, about this present-day prison system. Because although my dad, as well as others who have written books in this realm, in this arena that we're in, I often see the same people, although I don't regret seeing these same people. But what I do regret is that we haven't really touched the youth. We see, when Daddy was a Panther, and you look at our kids at that time, he wasn't able to pass down his teachings to my generation. He was unable to do that. You know, as we know, the political prisoners have been almost placed underneath the prisons. You know, they're trying to keep them as quiet and practically invisible. So if us, our people now who are conscious and very aware of political prisoners and this new day slavery prison system, if we don't reach out to our youth, you know, we can lose a whole lot. We really could. So this next generation, my generation, we must really, like, even if we have to go door to door and educate folks in the new year about their rights and what they can do to make a change, you know, we're going to lose. We're going to lose a lot of our youth if we don't make a change in this new year and involving more folks outside of ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So, and what about President Obama's second term? Are you looking or are you calling for any particular kind of activism or action to happen around the second term, or, you know, what are we calling for as citizens?
I don't want to go into Obama much as I would like to, but I can tell you when Clinton was leaving out on his second term, he freed some political prisoners, some Puerto Rican political prisoners. Now, I have heard, and recently a conversation with Selma James, she stated that we really, really need to press upon Obama to do something about this prison system and to free our political prisoners. Now, you know, we had 4 years in his first term, and we didn't really press upon him. I mean, Puerto Ricans now are pressing upon him to do something and free a couple of Puerto Rican political prisoners that are still incarcerated. And maybe we should address that issue with Obama. You know, I can't really tell with Obama sometimes. You know, he's smooth, he's educated. He's almost, when he talks to us, it's almost like he talks like a preacher. And you listen, and you listen closely. But yet I can't pin it down. But, yeah, that's a route we should go to address this issue, yes. So I thank you so much for having me. I mean, I could go on and on because this prison thing is bigger than all of us. And, you know, there's so much. But I thank you for having me. And hopefully if I'm in California doing a book tour, I will definitely visit you. But outside of that, SSS has been the ground base for this new awareness and Russell's case. Mm-hmm. And the book, so I want to give props to them, and they will definitely, SSS members, Kanya, maybe even Fred Ho, mm-hmm. and Quincy Saul will be in California, okay. Maybe even Matt Myers, hopefully. Well, whoever you get, mm-hmm. everyone is so deep and so educated and been in the movement for a while that, hey, you're going to get a good topic. You're going to get good folks. You're going to get good conversation, and then you'll get a good book.
Right.
So
yes.
I look forward to that.
And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
you know,
you.
I mean, you're at a hospital and visiting,
yeah.
you know, a sick, you know, friend
yeah.
and maybe relative, and you've taken
yeah.
out so much time to talk to us about what you've been doing, you know, over the past almost 50 years, you know, 40 years as, well, how many years as
right.
an adult?
Least 10 years or more. But listen, you know, all that I do, really, I'm swamped. I, like I said, I can see, look at my neighbor and see our youth go to hell because we have a state budget that claims it can't support our public school system. So I just want to request the folks that you may not be able to do everything that I do, but one, if you can just touch one youth, and it doesn't mean taking up all of your time, just a little note in their ear or some literature there. Because the youth on my block in the neighborhood, I live in, I talk to them throughout the summer when I'm in town and I'm not traveling, and they don't know half of the stuff that's going on. You know, you have to give them literature. You have to give them, what is it, movie, DVDs, you know, when King comes to Philadelphia and he visits with Pam Africa and myself, I always make sure that he meets youth in my neighborhood. And Pam and I showed his film in the park in my neighborhood, outdoors in the park.
Atlanta the Free, that film?
In Atlanta the Free, yeah. So even if you can't do an after-school program, you can't take people up to the prison, then you don't even have a loved one in the prison system, but you're aware of what's going on. Download something online, because you can just put in prison population, and you'll find out so much information. And pass that on. If you see a youth that's in trouble, you know, give them fair warning. This is where you could end up, and this is the pipeline that they want you to go through. So with all of that, I want to thank you and thank your listeners, and have a happy New Year's and happy Kwanzaa, and I enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, it was great talking to you too, Teresa. You take good care, and I hope, you know, we'll be talking about your father coming home very soon.
Definitely. I thank you so much.
All right,
bye-bye.
Peace, blessings. Bye-bye.
Peace.
So we're going to play another from Wolf Hawk Jaguar. It's called A Shoe or Exit.
Oh, daughter Kenya, whoa. See why you, Baba Kenya, whoa. That's your daughter Kenya, whoa. That's your see why you, go Mama Kenya. Oh, daughter Kenya, whoa. See why you, go Mama Kenya. And that's Baba Kenya,
as well, stronger, more determined, more self-determined, building stronger and tighter alliances. There's a song that Wolf Hawk Jagger sings about the rope and how we throw the rope. He talks about throwing the rope. We have to catch that rope, and we got to hold on to that rope, and we need to keep that rope tight and connected so we stay linked in this work, because it's hard doing things alone, but, you know, we all are connected to the same rope, and that could be a spiritual lineage, and that could be, it can also be tangible. Then the work is a lot easier, and we need to think African liberation. We need to think Umoja. We need to think Kujishagali or self-determination. We need to think about Ujima, collective work and responsibility. We need to think about Ujamaa, cooperative economics. We need to think about NIA or purpose. We need to think about Kaumba creativity, because creativity permeates and it moves through all of the different Nguzo Saba. And, of course, we have Imani, or faith, and that's how we got where we are as a people. We are still here after hundreds and hundreds of years of what might have exterminated a lesser people or a lesser determined people and a less strong people, but we've been resisting and we've been resisting. We're going to continue to resist and hold on to that rope and hold on to one another, because we are the rope, and think forward and think collective and think inclusion and think peace and justice. All righty, you take good care and see you on the other side. Peace and blessings.